Hello, and welcome to Thank the Academy, the podcast where we talk about every Academy Award-winning Best Picture in order. This is the Academy Archives, and this week, we're discussing Academy Award-winning film Who Framed Roger Rabbit and Academy Award-winning makeup artist V. Neal. We're your hosts, Zach and Kristen, and that's our producer, Kayla.
Howdy.
Hello.
Hello.
We're here.
We're here.
With a new episode.
Yeah.
Talking about some fun stuff from the year 1988.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, it feels so 80s right now. And it feels so wackadoodle. That's what we're talking about this week. Wackadoodle stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I've been deep in the makeup world of like Tim Burton.
Oh, interesting.
And you've been deep in the animated world of Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Both wackadoodle. But before we get too far into this episode, we have a Bosley review.
Huzzah.
Bosley likes to start off every archives with a good old-fashioned review of an animal performance.
Mm-hmm.
If you didn't know, Bosley is our pup, named for New York Times film critic Bosley Crowther. So Bosley is a critic in his own right and loves to review the performances of animals. Coming from the year 1988, Bosley wants to talk about Gorillas in the Mist.
Oh, Bosley.
The Sigourney Weaver film.
Okay.
There aren't really like dog movies from this year, so
yeah,
Bosley
yeah.
decided to go for gorillas.
All right. What's the next step, I guess?
So the movie is a little bit controversial, so we're not going to get into that.
Okay.
Just because the woman that Sigourney Weaver is playing is a little bit controversial.
Okay.
She just had many controversial tactics in saving these gorillas, which
okay.
is a valiant thing to do, but... she was also murdered.
Okay.
So we're not talking about the movie
this
Gorillas in the
Mist. This isn't about Gorillas in the Mist.
Bosley only wants to review the performances of the gorillas.
Okay.
So the gorillas were actually mostly wild gorillas that were in this.
Oh, wow.
There were a lot of really trained gorillas. These were gorillas that were in proximity to Diane Fossey, the woman, the real-life woman that Sigourney Weaver is playing.
Okay.
But the really trained gorillas were too used to human contact to be able to, like, portray the wild gorillas.
Interesting.
Of the story.
Yeah.
Because the story, of course, is set back several years, like
right.
when she first encountered the gorillas.
Yeah.
So luckily, the like wildlife preserve that she had sort of set up in Africa for the gorillas, there were many of the gorillas living there.
Mm.
And so they used those gorillas that were there who had minimal human contact,
sure.
but weren't like trained to do stuff.
Yeah, that makes sense.
The first gorilla that Sigourney really acted with was Maggie.
Oh, that's
the
such
gorilla.
A cute name.
And she was sort of the main gorilla. She like instantly like kind of bonded with Sigourney Weaver.
Mm.
And it was interesting because then they could really show her getting close to a human
yeah,
for real.
That's
because
so
she was
cute.
Actually getting close to Sigourney Weaver.
Wow, Maggie.
And while they were doing this, they wanted very minimal human contact. So only 5 crew people were allowed filming the scenes of the gorillas.
Wow.
So like a camera operator, the director, the cinematographer, basically like 2 other people, and then Sigourney Weaver.
Wow.
There was one silverback gorilla who was like head of the whole gorilla herd, basically,
yeah.
who ended up charging her 3 times during the making.
Just
as a show of dominance.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Only one time he actually made contact with her.
Uh-huh.
And he wasn't trying to hurt her.
Yeah.
It was
yeah.
just to be like, hey,
I'm the alpha
I'm
here.
The one that is in charge here.
Yeah.
So she said that was very like harrowing.
Yeah.
And one of the people who was on set during these times, one of the 5, was a trainer who worked with Diane, who was working
oh, wow.
with Sigourney, who knew the gorillas, who could mimic a lot of gorilla sounds and like
oh.
actually communicate with them.
Huh.
And then who would talk to her through an earpiece to be like, you know, this gorilla is behind you doing this. Don't make a sudden movement or like reach
oh
your arm
gosh.
This way or like coach her through these times when she was actually frightened and her character shouldn't be.
Oh my gosh. What a crazy acting experience for Sigourney Weaver.
Yeah. And so a large portion of the movie is like documentary style footage of the gorillas doing gorilla things with Sigourney Weaver.
Wow. That's wild, literally. But wow.
So Bosley was very impressed by this.
Wow, yeah, Boz, what an experience for you to watch.
Yeah. Penny, of course, was not allowed to watch this because she would have gone crazy.
Penny's anti-animal.
Yeah. So Boz had a nice time watching Gorillas in the Mist.
Wow. What was his critical response?
He was very impressed. I mean, the gorillas were performing as themselves, of course.
Sure.
And in Academy history, we know that this produces great work sometimes.
It does, yeah.
When non-trained actors mm-hmm. get to produce something that is like so akin to their normal life.
Yeah, Boz is very open-minded about those kinds of performances.
Yeah. So Bosley gives these gorilla performances a
What does that mean? And how did Bosley make that noise?
Well, he's talking like the gorillas do.
Okay.
Good job, Boz.
I still have yet to learn Bosley's rating system.
I mean, I don't know. It's hard to pin Bosley down, you know.
Yeah. He's an artist.
So, shall we get to Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
Yeah, I'm very excited about this. I love this movie.
Yeah, it's very fun. It was very fun rewatching in the context of mm-hmm. the history of the Academy Awards. So first, a recap. Private Detective Eddie Valiant, once a friend of Toon's, has now turned his back on them and become an alcoholic after his brother was killed by a mysterious Toon. Now Eddie must face his past to investigate Roger and Jessica Rabbit to see if Jessica is having an affair with Marvin Acme, owner of Acme Corporation and Toontown. But Acme is found murdered and Roger has been implicated, or framed. They search for Acme's will, which should indicate that the Toons inherit Toontown after his death, but they can't find it. Meanwhile, Acme Studios is acquired by Cloverleaf, the company that has also put the Pacific Electric Railway Company out of business. In a last-ditch effort, Eddie confronts Doom and discovers that he is the sole shareholder of Cloverleaf and plans to destroy Acme Studios and Toontown to make way for the new highway system in Los Angeles. And he's also the Toon that killed Eddie's brother. As they stand off near a new entrance to Toontown, Eddie realizes that Roger has had Acme's will all along, written in invisible ink, and it reveals that the Toons are the rightful owners of Toontown after all, and Doom is killed in his vat of Toon-killing dip. Eddie's faith in the Toons is restored, and his humor is returned, and he's finally feeling good about the world again. That is a plot point. He has lost his humor. So this film had a budget of around $50 to $60 million. It would have broken the record for highest budget all time of any film had Rambo 3 not eclipsed its budget in the same year. And it ended up grossing $351 million, which is amazing.
Yeah.
It became the second highest grossing film of the year 1988.
Nice.
Behind our Best Picture winner, Rain Man, of course.
Very strange.
So the story, which I did not realize, started as a novel.
Called
Who Censored Roger Rabbit? It was written by...
I've heard that title before.
Yeah. It was written by Gary K. Wolfe, published in 1981. The novel's plot was fairly similar to the film adaptation, but all of the Toons in the novel are characters from cartoon comic strips, not from cartoon films.
Gotcha.
In the world of the story, the comics are made from the Toons being photographed. So that is like the world of the story then.
Oh, that's how they work. The Toons get photographed for their job kind of a thing.
And that's how they become comic strips.
Gotcha.
So all Toons speak in speech bubbles in their normal life. And then when they're photographed saying their lines, the speech bubbles are there.
Gotcha.
But some have learned to speak without them. They also have the ability to make duplicates of themselves that last a few minutes or hours for the use of performing the stunts in the cartoons and the comic strips that would be too dangerous for them to attempt. One day, Rogers is lasting longer, and he is murdered. So then his duplicate has to help Eddie Valiant solve his murder before he disappears.
Oh, the original
is murdered.
Is murdered.
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting too.
So then the murder is solved right before his duplicate disappears.
Gotcha.
So he has justice.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
I just love worlds like that where it's like, take this mundane little idea and let's expand it so huge into this crazy thing.
And a lot of like classic comic strip characters appear.
Sure. Like Popeye or...
Yeah, and Peanuts.
Peanuts.
Yeah. Family Circus.
Yeah.
So, pretty interesting. Walt Disney Productions purchased the rights to the film almost immediately, seeing its potential for a film. Jeffrey Price and Peter Seaman were hired to write the script, and Robert Zemeckis immediately threw in his own name to direct. But he had just come off two major flops in the early 80s with I Want to Hold Your Hand and Used Cars. So they did not give him the job then.
So sad.
Disney spent the next 2 years doing test footage to find the best way to work the animation and live action together, using Paul Rubens as the voice of Roger and Peter Ranaday as Eddie Valiant. Mm. As Disney changed CEOs in the mid-80s, the project stalled for a moment, but then Michael Eisner was quick to see its potential as well after he was like in the mix of things. As the budget began to balloon, he reached out to Spielberg and Amblin as they had begun producing their own animation.
Right.
In the 80s.
We just went over that.
And knew that they could help add to the budget. He grew nervous as the budget grew even more, but Disney studio chairman Jeffrey Katzenberg convinced him that the project would be incredibly groundbreaking, going so far as to say that it would save Disney animation.
Which is not a bad thought.
He was right
yeah.
on both of those.
Right.
Yeah.
Not only does it become so innovative that it wins all these technical awards, it does help Disney bounce back.
Yeah, especially from the amount of money they made.
Yeah.
Spielberg's contract ended up giving him more of the creative control, which is interesting, and a large percentage of the film's profits, but Disney would retain all of the merchandising.
Oh, okay.
As they are wont to do.
Yeah.
With Spielberg at the helm, other studios were then convinced to lend more of their characters for the venture, with Warner Brothers, Fleischer Studios, Harvey Comics, King Features Syndicate, Felix the Cat Productions, Turner Entertainment, and Universal Walter Lantz all lending characters for the film.
Mm.
The characters that they wanted that they were unable to acquire were Popeye, Tom and Jerry, Little Lulu, Casper, and the Terry Toons characters.
Oh, bummer. Yeah. I mean, it is cool. I've watched this movie with my parents several times.
Yeah.
And my dad's always like, look at all those guys. They're all together. Do you know they're all from different studios? I'm like, wow, Dad.
Several of the main characters ended up coming with stipulations, mostly the Warner Brothers characters.
Sure.
Partly the main stipulation was that they couldn't appear for less amount of time than the Disney characters.
Oh, sure.
Which is why Donald Duck and Daffy Duck are in the same scene, and then Mickey Mouse and Bugs Bunny are in the same scene.
Which is just so fun.
Yeah.
I mean, it's such a fun movie.
Yeah. In addition to getting these characters, also almost all of their original voice actors were hired for the film as well.
Oh, that's cool.
Which is pretty amazing. Finally, after directing Romancing the Stone and Back to the Future to great success, Robert Zemeckis was actually seen as a good candidate for the role of director and was hired in 1985. Spielberg and Zemeckis then made the decision to go against Disney and hire a non-Disney person to direct all of the animation in Richard Williams. He was known most for directing animated opening sequences to movies like What's New Pussycat, A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, Casino Royale, and the Pink Panther movies.
Mm-hmm.
His most critical success came from directing the 1971 animated Christmas Carol.
I was just going to say, I talked about this guy.
Yeah.
That's because I talked about this short.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which won him the Academy Award for Best Animated Short Film.
Yes. That was so weird. I was like, why can I not understand why I know all this stuff?
He was keen to be out from the watchful eye of Disney and was able to convince them to move the whole production to the United Kingdom rather than in LA.
Well, yeah, and that makes sense. Also, he's known for his darker style of animation, which, I mean, Disney is going through kind of a darker period with the Black Cauldron and Oliver and Company and such being of the time right now. But his animation style is a little bit more gruesome.
Yeah.
And so it makes sense that it's like, let's step away from Disney a little bit, which is one of the things that's so great about Roger Rabbit is that it's so extreme, like for being an animated, partially animated thing.
Yeah. So they did allow this, in that they ended up for this movie creating Disney Animation United Kingdom Studios.
Disney always has a way.
But it would be a good move, like you were saying, because he was able to avoid like constant oversight then and like bureaucracy of like the Burbank studio.
Yeah.
And then Michael Eisner's not like there the whole time.
Right.
Which is good.
Yeah.
Harrison Ford was Spielberg's first choice for the role of Eddie Valiant.
Of course he was. He always is his first choice.
Which would be really fun.
Actually, yeah, that would have been fun. I'm sure he may have enjoyed it too.
Yeah. His asking price was too high.
Sure. Makes sense.
So they couldn't have him in the movie. Then the role was offered to Chevy Chase. And he was not interested.
Crisis averted.
Eddie Murphy didn't understand the concept of the film. So he said no, which he later said was one of his biggest like career regrets because they basically were offering the film to him.
Yeah, yeah.
He's like at his height in the 80s now. And so, which also would have been really fun. This is also a crazy story. So Bill Murray was offered the role.
Yeah.
But I don't know if you know about Bill Murray and how he takes roles.
I know literally nothing about Bill Murray.
So this is really weird. But Bill Murray has a P.O. box.
Okay.
Still to this day. This is how he's always accepted roles. And nobody knows where it is or what it is. But people who are in the industry get it and send him stuff. And like this is the way that he communicates. He doesn't have a cell phone or anything like that.
Okay.
So he has missed out on many, many, many roles that were offered to him. Because he either like wasn't checking his P.O. box or people didn't know how to get a hold of him.
Oh my gosh, why would you be that way?
So he missed out on this role. This was one of the roles.
Ugh.
So a few roles that I just wanted to mention because this is really weird and dumb. They wanted to audition him for Han Solo. And he just never got the communication.
Okay.
So he didn't audition for that. They offered him the role in Splash that Tom Hanks ended up getting. They wanted him to audition for Woody.
Oh, yeah, totally.
And for Buzz. He didn't do that. Little Miss Sunshine was written for him to star in.
As which character?
As
the dad?
Yeah, as Frank.
Oh, as Frank.
Yeah, Steve Carell played Frank.
Oh, not the dad. Okay.
Yeah, so the script was written for him in mind. And he just never responded to the communication and they couldn't get a hold of him. So they cast Steve Carell.
Well, I'm not mad about that, honestly. Because I love Steve Carell in that role.
Another one was Forrest Gump.
What a dum-dum. Why does he do that?
I don't know.
I guess his career has been fine, so it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
But still.
So he missed out on this movie.
Okay.
Spielberg and Zemeckis ended up discussing the role with a huge list of people. Robin Williams, Robert Redford, Jack Nicholson, Sylvester Stallone, Edward James Olmos, Wallace Shawn, Ed Harris, Charles Grodin, and Don Lane.
What's funny is I can picture a lot of those people in this movie.
Yeah.
Like, no problem.
The role is not a very specific role, so it can fit a lot of different types of performers.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting.
Finally, of course, they landed on Bob Hoskins. Spielberg felt like he looked very of the era, and he also felt like, even though he didn't really do comedy, he felt like he had a certain softness to him.
Yeah, and a certain gruffness to him, too.
Yeah. Charles Fleischer ended up being cast as Roger, and during filming, to help Hoskins on set, actually dressed in a full Roger Rabbit costume and delivered his lines just off camera.
I did know about that. I think that's hilarious and insane.
Yeah.
Just totally wackadoodle.
Christopher Lloyd was cast as Judge Doom due to his familiarity with Zemeckis and Spielberg. Also, he famously doesn't blink on camera in any of his scenes to appear more menacing.
Yeah, and like the secret cartoon underneath.
Yeah. He is very scary. They didn't hire Tim Curry because they thought that he was going to be too scary.
He is very scary.
Yeah.
his face alone scares me. But I mean, when I was younger, I didn't see this movie till I was maybe a teenager, and I was not allowed to see it when I was younger because it was too scary. And then when I saw it, I was like, oh my gosh, this is like...
It's also a little more risque and adult themes for a Disney film.
Miss Jessica.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in early drafts of the script, Jessica Rabbit is the main villain.
Oh no.
Just because like Doom is not really a character in the novel. So they kind of had to restructure that.
Yeah.
And then in another iteration, Baby Herman is the villain.
I mean, that is very, very close call there anyways.
And then, of course, they settled on Doom. His Toon Patrol was created to spoof the Seven Dwarfs.
Oh.
But two of them ended up being cut to save animation time. Their names are Stupid, Smartass, Greasy, Wheezy, and Psycho. And then the two that were cut were Slimy and Sleazy.
Ah, nice.
All modeled after the dwarfs. Also in an earlier draft, it is revealed that Doom is the character that killed Bambi's mother.
Oh my gosh. Why did they cut that?
I don't know. So he has a very notorious past.
He's a dark, dark tune.
One note on the dip, they decided to make it very realistic, the dip.
Yeah.
It's revealed to be made of turpentine, benzene, and acetone, which are what animators actually use
to eliminate,
to wipe off their cells.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah. So that is how cartoon characters are really erased. Mm-hmm. Rubber mannequins were made of all the main characters to stand in where they were supposed to be on set for the actors' eye lines.
Oh, that's fun.
And then live action props that were being held by the characters were moved using robotic arms or pulled or pushed with invisible strings or wires so that the animated characters would appear to be more grounded.
Mm-hmm.
Spielberg and Williams decided early on that the animated characters always needed to be touching something real so that it didn't look like they were sort of just floating.
Superimposed or something, yeah. Well, and that's one of the strengths of the movie is that anytime there's an animated character, there is breath in the scene that makes it feel like they're there. Like,
well, and they often did other things like knocking over boxes or when they sit down, like some dust flies up.
Exactly.
Or like it's all very practical to like fit the animations in so that like they're interacting with the real world as much as the people are, which is very smart.
Yeah.
Once Eisner and Roy Disney saw a more finished film, they grew worried that it was too risque for their regular audience. So they made the decision to release it under their Touchstone Pictures banner rather than as a Walt Disney Animated Studios release.
Which is smart, too.
When the movie came out, it had the best first weekend of any Disney film up to that point in history.
Wow.
Grossing over $11 million in its first weekend.
Yeah. Well, and we're in a time where that kind of movie is so popular. Like, it makes me think a lot about, like, Ghostbusters and stuff where there's this, like,
Well, combo. And this is when, like, blockbuster comedies are also at their peak.
Yeah, exactly.
So everybody wants to go see and spend money on a comedy.
On fun, yeah. Mm-hmm.
The film received nearly universal acclaim from critics as well. It was listed immediately as one of the best comedies of all time, which is a bit of a stretch, I think, as an extremely important film, very innovative. Roger Ebert listed it as his second favorite movie of 1988, calling it, quote, sheer enchanted entertainment from the first frame to the last, a joyous, giddy, goofy celebration of the kind of fun you can have with a movie camera.
Mm. I mean, and that's exactly what I would say about it, too, is that it's entertainment in the purest way, where it's like fun and it's something that can only happen on the screen.
He wrote that the opening, quote, is a masterpiece. I can't remember the last time I laughed so hard at an animated short. But then when a stunt goes wrong and the cartoon baby stalks off the set and lights a cigar and tells the human director to go to hell, we know we're in a new and special universe.
So true. Hilarious.
Janet Maslin of the New York Times said it was, quote, a film whose best moments are so novel, so deliriously funny, and so crazily unexpected that they truly must be seen to be believed.
Yeah.
It was interesting that a bunch of our regular critics like were all out or something. They didn't, like, Pauline Kael never reviewed this film, and Vincent Canby didn't review this film either.
Interesting.
Which is really interesting.
Yeah.
I don't know why. So we have other people who reviewed it instead in their
place. They were like, well, this one's a fun, there's nothing bad to say about it, so you guys take this one and we'll do the more critical responses.
It turned out to be the perfect mix of reigniting interest in the golden age of Hollywood animation. It then solidified the beginning of what is now titled the Silver Age of Animation. So the golden age of animation is considered once animation is synced with sound.
Sure.
And there's basically animated shorts playing
all the time.
All the time in theaters before every single movie. It's like, you know, all the way up into the 60s. That's the golden age. And then we have, you know, sort of a downtime in animation. People are not really interested in it anymore. And then the silver age, all of a sudden, all these new studios are cropping up. We're having stuff like Miyazaki is getting really popular.
Amblin comes around.
Amblin comes around, starts producing stuff. Don Bluth is also producing his own stuff.
Pixar's about to start up.
Pixar's about to start. And then, of course, we get the golden age of Disney in particular, the Renaissance era of Disney. Everybody's just very interested in animation in the 90s.
Yes, yes, yes.
It also helps that they just re-released Snow White, which we've mentioned a few times. But Snow White had its 50th anniversary, and so it was very popular during this time again.
And it's so hard to stress on a podcast like this how big of a deal that is because, I mean, we have existed with VHS our whole life. So we've always had home media. But for so many people, and for I'm sure many of our listeners too, who have lived in the time before VHS, that was not a thing. You had to go to the movies to see a movie or see it on TV. And so,
and a lot of Disney movies didn't air on television. It was like one of their things that they specifically didn't license very many of their films for television until much later.
And so to bring it back into the pop culture was a huge thing. It influenced many, many people all over again, the way it did way back when.
So I just want to go through the Academy Awards that it was nominated for, because it was nominated for 6 competitive Oscars, which is really amazing. And of course, it is a live action film in addition to animation,
but
it's one of the most nominated animated films. So it was nominated for Best Art Direction, Best Cinematography, Best Film Editing, Best Sound Effects Editing, and Best Visual Effects. Of course, it went on to win 4 Oscars for Best Film Editing, Best Sound Effects Editing, Best Visual Effects, and a Special Achievement Award for Richard Williams as Director of Animation. So very cool. We're getting into a new era of Disney, a new era of just like animation in general, whether it's hand-drawn or CGI or, you know, any kind of like composite. We're going through this time where like a lot of the action movies are also pushing this as well because of like
Tron and
Terminator. And they're all like trying to do things with bigger and better special effects and, you know,
animation, even CGI a tiny bit is like starting to come around.
Because you can do a lot more interesting stuff that like human actors can't do, like the Terminator melt into like a metal man. So so a very interesting era for that. And of course, Disney, as always, is pushing the boundaries and pushing forward the like money to like get more of this technology going.
I'm very excited. This is getting me really revved up because we're about to teeter into the Renaissance for Disney, which is so important in my life. We're also like getting so close to our lifespans, which is crazy to me.
The 90s.
Because like when I think of Who Framed Roger Rabbit, I think of it as a movie that like my parents saw before they had me, you know, like when they were a couple. Which is just so weird.
So that's what I have to share about Who Framed Roger Rabbit. Very, very fun. And let's pivot and start talking about V. Neil.
So I am very excited to talk about her today. I realized as I was doing my research, because I got so excited and was so like amazed and like really into it. But I realized that it is an extremely hard thing to talk about makeup artistry on a podcast because so much of what's amazing is the visuals. So I'm going to do my best, but you know. I highly, highly recommend going and looking at either her. She has an Instagram. She's alive today. She's kicking and doing work all the time. And she has an active Instagram. So you can always go there to like see clips of her doing stuff, which is really cool. Or even just some of her past work. Honestly, just incredible. But let's get into it.
Yeah, I'm excited because I don't really know her. I know her work from what you've mentioned. But
I figured pretty much nobody would know who this person is unless you're in the makeup industry.
Yeah.
So, and of course, I like to highlight women who are at the top of the game. And she is one of, I mean, she is the foremost makeup artist who's a woman. She did some of the greatest work in the last like 20 years or more than that.
30, 40.
Oh my gosh, we're in the 20s now. 30, 40, whatever. Anyways. So, V. Neal was actually born with the name Mary Flores, but she goes by V. Neal. That's her guild name, all that kind of stuff. She was born in 1951. And just a little overview so you kind of know what's going on. She is a 3-time Oscar winner with 8 nominations. She currently has the 3rd most wins and nominations.
Wow.
And the most for any woman
Wow.
in the makeup industry. She's just behind Rick Baker, who has 7 wins and 11 nominations. And the two of them have worked together several times. They both won an Oscar together for the film Ed Wood.
Oh.
And then she's worked with him. He was the head makeup artist for How the Grinch Stole Christmas, which she and many, many other prominent makeup artists worked on.
Yeah.
And then she's also just behind Greg Cannon, who has 4 wins and 10 nominations. She's also tied for wins with Marc Collier, but he only has 5 nominations, whereas she has 8. So I think that tips her over a little bit. She's also won an Emmy for The Shining TV series and a daytime Emmy for Pee-wee's Playhouse.
Oh, nice.
She's also the first makeup artist to be awarded the Hollywood Foreign Press Makeup Artist of the Year.
Oh.
And she's also the first makeup artist to be the MAC Cosmetics Makeup Artist of the Year. Pretty amazing. She's had a long partnership with Tim Burton. He kind of gave her her breakout and has created many characters for him, like Beetlejuice, Edward Scissorhands. She did Batman Returns, Ed Wood, Mars Attacks, and Sweeney Todd. In addition, she's created so many memorable characters. She's been the head of many makeup departments, but in being so, she's touched so many characters. So she has a lot of responsibility for many of the characters we know, but some of her most famous are Mrs. Doubtfire.
Oh, wow.
Edward Scissorhands, Effie Trinket, Jack Sparrow, Jennifer Lawrence's Mystique, the characters from The Lost Boys in the 80s, Beetlejuice, along with countless aliens, citizens of the Capitol, and Davy Jones's crew.
Oh, wow. Very cool.
She's been the head of the makeup artist department on many franchises as well, including all of the Hunger Games films and the Pirates of the Caribbean films. She received the Lifetime Achievement Award from the local Makeup Artists and Hairstylists Guild and was presented it by her longtime partner, creative partner, and muse, Johnny Depp. She worked on him for many, many, many of his works, not just under Tim Burton.
And for hours and hours
and hours. And hours, yes, in 2016. And she was the first female makeup artist to win this award. She's considered to be an incredibly unique talent for her film makeup and special effects, and also for her ability to not, I mean, monsters are her main thing, but her ability to design unique beauty looks as well that kind of skew what traditional beauty may be. Some good examples of like more natural styles of this would be like Jennifer Lawrence in The Hunger Games, who's an iconic character that has to have a very specific look, but it's so natural, like, you know, and yet she has to be maintained through all of her capital looks and her district looks and like in the arena, like she has to remain herself, which is pretty cool. And she also has done many, many like wounds and things like that for many people. Let's just talk about her career a little bit. She knew she wanted to be a makeup artist from the age of 5. She loved monsters. Like, she loved creating and making people look crazy. She was known for painting the faces of her cousins with anything that was around. Lipstick, shoe polish, whatever she could do to make them look nuts. Her interest was further piqued by Leo Lotito, who was one of her neighbors, who worked as a makeup artist on several TV shows and helped her out with her Halloween costumes.
Oh, interesting.
Which I can only imagine her Halloween costumes were great.
Yeah.
She remembers saying, "Oh, Mr. Lotito, I want to do what you do when I grow up," and was able to kind of get some guidance from him as she got older.
Well, that's cool.
And of course, she is great in her own right. I mean, her work stands for itself, but there's also an element for so many people like her of like growing up in the right place at the right time with the right people stepping into your life at the right moment. I mean, it's like Marley Matlin. It's like, what if Henry Winkler never saw her perform?
Right.
You know, stuff like that where, I don't know, what's meant to be will be, but also a little luck helps. At 18, she started to work as a costume designer for a rock band that wanted very funky space age outfits. So because of this, she took a trip to a science fiction convention to get inspiration, where she ran into Fred Phillips, who is the creator, the makeup artist behind the original Star Trek series.
Oh, wow. Nice.
So she met him there. He took a liking to her and ended up taking her under his wings and gave her her first big break, a job on a 1979 Star Trek, the motion picture, which set her career off in a way that nobody could have expected.
Yeah, seriously.
She considers herself to be self-taught. She's tried to learn from artists along the way. She never went to any formal school for it. She considers herself very grateful to be able to have watched a lot of great legends throughout time. She studied the work of John Chambers, who worked on Planet of the Apes, and got to work under him.
Oh, wow.
So she was able to learn quite a bit from him. And also from Fred Phillips with Star Trek. Her time working with him was really influential in not only like her style, but her ability to see people and transform them while keeping them there too, if that makes sense. Like, it's a really different thing to put a mask on somebody than it is to let the actor or the person come through the makeup.
Mrs. Doubtfire still looks like Robin Williams.
Yeah, exactly.
But very different.
I mean, I would say all of her characters are that way. Edward Scissorhands and...
Well, some of them aren't wearing like full face prosthetics like Robin Williams.
Okay, or Beetlejuice. I mean, Michael Keaton is still there.
Yeah.
You can't erase the man. And while she was developing her skills, she found that it was really hard because there was a lack of sharing from her male counterparts to her. She often felt like the only woman in the room. She felt like she was unwanted. And she also felt that she really had to prove herself, especially with monster makeup, because it was just a very male dominated field. There's kind of this assumption that a lot of women don't have the like gruesomeness to be able to create visceral creatures the way that men could.
It's always so strange to me that the makeup, special effects makeup, became very male dominated also. I mean, because I mean, it makes sense because it's Hollywood, but it doesn't make sense because like growing up, I never would have thought, like, I don't know, men weren't allowed to experiment with that kind of thing at all. And so it was like, in my mind, only women were getting to do that kind of stuff in general. So it's like, I don't know, it's just one of those weird, like,
the industry even more keeps everything
backward things.
Yeah.
So strange.
So Star Trek, of course, was a huge deal for her and opened the door. Her next job right after this was a bit of a pivot, but she was Lily Tomlin's makeup artist in the movie 9 to 5.
Oh, nice.
Which then allowed her to create a partnership with Lily Tomlin. She's done her makeup several times for specials, for other things since then. After 9 to 5, she mostly did some TV movies that were of the sci-fi variety until she was booked as a makeup artist on the series The A-Team for 61 episodes.
Oh, wow. Good for her.
Which is another great example of her work because it is a lot of wounds, a lot of violence and bruises and dirt and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
You can imagine.
Yeah, people know the A-Team.
Yeah. after this, the next like notorious thing that she did was The Lost Boys. Which she has continued to say is one of her favorite movies she's ever worked on, mostly because it really suited her abilities. It was a good mix of horror and vampire and blood and guts and violence and weirdness and stuff like that. It allowed her to showcase a lot of her skills. During this film, she was approached by the art director, B. Welch, who said that he had recently received a script for a movie that was really cool and might be very much up her alley. He was like, you got to come talk to the team about it. And she was like, okay, like tell me who's in production and maybe I'll know somebody who's working on it and then I can try to get myself a job on it. She like read the script. She thought it was really cool. So he waited to get the crew list. When he finally got it, he gave it to her, and the production manager on it happened to have been the first AD on 9 to 5, but had moved up in the ranks.
Nice.
And now had hiring power. His name was Rich Hashimoto. And he was now producing and doing a bunch of stuff for this new film that was going to be kind of a different style than anything that had happened before, called Beetlejuice. So she called him. They talked about it, but he was like, listen, it's too early. I haven't like finalized stuff. We don't know how production's going to be yet. So like, we got to wait. And so she talks about how she just really wanted to work on this. She just thought it was going to be so perfect for her. So she called him every week, week after week after week, until finally he was like, oh my gosh, okay, I will set up a meeting with Tim for you.
Yeah.
And she was like, okay, great, perfect. So they have this meeting. And she's very surprised by Tim Burton. He's much younger than she expects. He's much wackier than she expects.
Yeah.
And she also didn't realize that he did a lot of his own drawing of the characters.
Okay.
A big part of his process is the design of the characters himself because he's a visual artist.
Right.
And so in their talk, they were able to kind of get on the same page and found a common language between them. And he ended up hiring her. And she just went off with Beetlejuice. She had a hand in almost every character, from Winona Ryder's like goth teen Lydia look to all the inhabitants of the undead waiting room. But of course, her biggest contribution is the creation of Beetlejuice.
Yeah.
So I wanted to read some of her quotes because she's talked about this. This is just about her experience. She said, quote, Tim had some drawings up on the wall, literally sketches of the character, which he did on all the movies I've worked on with him. This particular character kind of looked derelict, so I copied the sketch. It was on this like crummy little corkboard in a trailer that everybody was working out of. She went to the makeup trailer to work on Michael Keaton and do a couple of iterations of the character. And Michael Keaton had some ideas as well that he kind of gave to her. She was kind of compositing all these things together. As they were going, Michael Keaton really wanted to look different than he does. Mm. That was his main thing. He was like, I don't want to look in the mirror and see myself. I want to see Beetlejuice.
Yeah.
So she asked if anyone had broken noses. Unfortunately, they didn't have any broken noses available, but they did have swollen lips. So they put that on him. They glued the lips, and then they kind of created like a makeshift broken nose. They made some decaying teeth. And then they continued to work on a color palette that would look very cartoony, very pale, almost whitish yellow, trying to mimic the colors that were in the original sketch. The other thing about the colors is that they wanted like lots of things that were working together, but not blending together. So his look is a little bit patchy.
Yeah.
They dyed the wig a pale lime green, and then she sent a PA off to the hobby store asking for some crushed green foam, like the ones they use on model kits for moss and stuff, so that they could put the moss in his hair, making it look like he just crawled out from underneath a rock.
Right.
Which also is like a essential part of his look now. They put it like under his hairline, under on his neck, just wherever they could. When Keaton looked in his reflection for the first time, he loved it. He started jumping up and down. He started going off, just being so excited. It was like more than what he had envisioned for himself. So she took pictures of this and sent them to Burton, who, as she said, quote, approved them in a typically understated way, saying, okay, that works. So that's how we created Beetlejuice. It really was by the seat of our pants. And for her Beetlejuice makeup, she received her first Academy Award nomination and win.
Oh, huzzah.
This also made her Tim Burton's makeup artist of choice.
Yes.
And she then went on to work on all of his U.S. productions.
Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah, which, I mean, for a makeup artist is a perfect partnership.
Well, and it makes sense as somebody, like if somebody can get your vision, then... I mean, he has his own sort of look to uphold throughout all of his movies.
Yeah. Like, he's very stylized.
Yeah, his style, you can tell when you're watching a Tim Burton movie.
Yeah.
And like, it makes sense that if somebody's going to get his style, he wants them for everything.
I mean, he's that way with everything, with musicians, with actors.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right after this, because of her partnership with Tim Burton, she went on to do a bunch of the Pee Wee Herman stuff.
Of course.
So she did not work on the original movie, so she is not responsible for the original look, but she was responsible for maintaining Pee Wee's look throughout his movies, his entire series, and then she also did many of the other characters that came and went throughout the whole series. After Pee Wee, her next big thing was being the department head for Edward Scissorhands, which... after working on Beetlejuice, it seemed like it was going to be a perfect fit. They ended up working in Southern Florida, which like was really tough because it was very melty. So she had like a lot of challenge. She did get to assemble her own crew of makeup artists, which was really cool. And she brought on her own assistant, Matthew Mungall, who ended up winning his own Oscar later on, but he became an assistant for her on several projects as well. From costume department to makeup chair, the process of turning Johnny Depp into Edward took about an hour and 45 minutes every day. The scars that he had were made of foam and had to be glued on individually. And this is one thing that she talks about quite a bit, is that she was just not a fan of the scars' quality. In retrospect, she says this is like the one thing, if she could go back and change, she would. She just was really disappointed with the way that they looked on his face, as a combination of the material, the product, and also like the heat and the inability to maintain it. During filming, she and Johnny Depp worked together quite a bit on the makeup look, because he goes in and out of different versions of himself quite a bit. And they realized that they could change his expression without him having to change his face by adjusting the shape of the dark circles around his eyes. So when he's in a lighter mood, his eyes are framed in a way that emphasizes his more innocent gaze with sharper angles. And then when he's more vicious, when he's like the killer and stuff, his eyeshadow is fuller, but more rounded, drawn down to create a more manic look. That way, Johnny Depp could maintain the acting style that Tim Burton wanted, and she could create the like emotions and expressions that they all wanted as well. Again, just a trio partnership that worked very well, that ended up becoming a staple of his films going forward.
Yeah, that's really cool. You don't really think about that when you're watching the movie. I mean, it comes across because you are seeing everything visually, but like, you don't think about how much that affects it.
Right. And I mean, you really like the movie, so I know that you've seen it quite a few times. Next time you watch it, you'll have to watch his expressions and just...
Well, and I know that they change throughout the movie. Like, his look does change in and out, and like...
But like, you'll have to try to watch how the makeup emotes for him.
Yeah, right.
Which is just such an interesting concept. She followed this up with more stuff with him. She did Batman Returns. She's responsible for the Penguin look, along with several of the other looks, but that's like an interesting look, so I wanted to highlight that.
Yeah.
She also did the movie Hook.
Oh, yeah.
Where she was Julia Roberts' makeup artist on that. And this is where she connected with famed actor Robin Williams. And right after this, she goes on to do some of the greatest work of her career, Mrs. Doubtfire. So this is the most difficult thing that she does in her whole career. She talks about this extensively, how it was just so, so hard. So she had to cover Robin Williams' face with 12 or 13 foam latex pieces that all had to overlap. There couldn't even be a centimeter of his face showing, or sweat bubbles would appear. If skin showed, she'd have to keep filling in that area. So she did this all day, every day. She said she probably did the makeup on him 53 times, and she spent nearly 4.5 hours a day transforming him.
That's crazy.
Yeah, which also like sucks for him. I mean, she worked on both this and How the Grinch Stole Christmas, which are two movies where I'm like, those poor actors.
Yeah,
that's like, it's kind of soul crushing to be going through that physical stuff so much. I know Jim Carrey's talked endlessly about that for the Grinch, but just rough.
Yeah, I mean, he literally says it's like
yeah, torture. Being tortured, and he had to learn like torture techniques to survive it, and whatever. He took up smoking, you know, all that stuff. So V. Neil fashioned Mrs. Doubtfire's likeness with a multi-piece latex mask and then extensive makeup. The multi-piece mask was also designed by fellow artists Dick Smith and Greg Kamen, and it was pieced together daily, painted daily. And then they were challenged with molding the prosthetics into a seamless mask as well, to allow for a bunch of different facial expressions, and also like to be able to reproduce the blemishes and wrinkles of Mrs. Doubtfire for every day, which is just nuts. She also talks a lot about, and I wanted to mention this because we're talking about prosthetics, how much she cares about skincare. Is very, very heavily involved in her actors' skincare routines. She does not allow actors to leave the set with any makeup on. And she always provides a kit for her actors, especially anyone who is doing prosthetics, to be able to like take care of their skin. And she also is a little bit more careful with women because their skin is more delicate on their face, since they don't have shave or have like beard, whatever. So it's a little bit thinner and more prone to breaking. And she talks a lot about how like she's very careful to remove the prosthetics, but there's no way to not wear and tear people's faces with it. So she's very, very adamant about those things. This is one thing that she and Robin Williams worked together to maintain his face, so that he wasn't like ripped up after doing this every day. And for all of this hard work, it paid off because she won the Oscar. And it goes down in history as one of the biggest transformations. I mean, that's the whole point of the movie, obviously. Yeah. But like, it's so funny to me that a movie like this could be so successful because it's such a fun family movie and it requires so much technical work.
Yeah.
Well, so much like, so that it won an Oscar.
It has to be believable that they don't recognize him. Like,
yeah.
And it is like,
he looks like a woman.
Yeah.
Like through and through. So those were some of the ones I really wanted to highlight. Her last Oscar win, as of now, because who knows, was for the film Ed Wood, mm-hmm. which is another Tim Burton film with Johnny Depp. And in this film, I've not seen this one, but it's a lot of classic monsters.
Yeah.
Lots of classic monster makeup, which is like her bread and butter. So she had a lot of fun on this one. She also got to work with Rich Baker, which was fun. And yeah, so going forward, I just wanted to highlight some of the other things that she's done that are a little bit farther in history than we are. But of course, she worked on How the Grinch Stole Christmas alongside of many, many artists, mm-hmm. because that one required such extensive makeup. She worked on Austin Powers and Goldmember. Mm. She did Danny DeVito's work for that. He was his makeup artist. She's the makeup department head for Pirates of the Caribbean 1, 2, and 3. So she created Jack Sparrow's iconic look, which is another one of the most iconic character looks in history, while also working on Keira Knightley, Orlando Bloom. She did the Balboa transformation makeup as he kind of becomes crazy, you know, and ragged and all that stuff. All of the Davy Jones crew. It's really cool to see the behind the scenes pictures from this because she's sitting there with like an actor who's sitting in the seat with like, you know, starfish in his chest.
Yeah.
Like just really cool.
Very
like,
fun.
Very creative makeup. She's also, of course, the head of the department for every Hunger Games movie. She created some of Effie Trinket's most beautiful, iconic looks. The butterfly look that's like been preserved. That's like her eyelashes in that, all that stuff. Beautiful. Lots of creative makeup with the Capitol members. And then, like I was saying before, maintaining our iconic characters throughout all these different iterations like Katniss and Peeta and so on.
Making Peeta look like a cake.
Some of her best work to date. She also had to work with a lot of kids on this movie. Is something she talks about is like, it's very challenging to do makeup for kids and especially,
well, and kids are more often going to like touch their face and like mess it up.
Especially, luckily for this film, they did not require a lot of wounds on kids because that is a very challenging thing. And they just don't show it a lot in the Hunger Games.
Right.
But all the Capitol children have unique looks. And even the ones in the Hunger Games like have to have a certain way of being. And of course, as they're paraded through the districts and stuff. She was also the makeup head for The Amazing Spider-Man, the Andrew Garfield ones.
Oh, cool.
So she worked on all those. Lots of cool pictures of her with like Andrew Garfield and stuff. Doing all, especially for that, it's a lot of wound makeup.
Yeah.
There's like a part where he gets cut up all over his face and stuff.
Well, and in the transition of like the lizard guy too.
Yeah.
Like I know a lot of him is CGI, but then as he's like coming out of the lizard back to the doctor, he's like,
still got to be
practical makeup there.
And speaking of, this is a good transition for me. She is very pro CGI, which I wasn't sure. I wanted to like look into like what her thoughts on that were as a makeup artist.
Well, and especially for the Pirates films, they do such a big mix of like CGI and practical.
And that's what she talks about a lot. She says, quote, CGI is a helpful tool, but it will never be the sole method in the field. Going on to talk about how when the two can work together, you can create something really magical, something beyond what human hands can do, but also something grounded in reality. And that's like her whole thing is like she loves practical monster makeup, but she also recognizes like there are things that, especially movement wise, that you can't do.
Well, and especially with Davy Jones, like his tentacles have to be animated because he is like a tentacly creature.
Yes.
So like obviously those can't be practical.
Yeah.
But if you see him, like pictures of him on set, he does have a ton of practical makeup effects on him.
And also, I mean, from an actor's perspective, it is really helpful to look at Davy Jones and see Davy Jones instead of a guy in a green bodysuit.
Yeah.
You know? That just sucks. Like, I'm not gonna bash movies. I was gonna say reference movies where they require people to stand around in suits and do stuff, but anyways,
I mean, there definitely is some of that in Pirates, but
sure. All the same, it's really cool to see practical makeup work She, the last thing I wanted to mention is that she was the makeup head for A Star Is Born, the most recent one.
Oh, interesting.
Which I just wanted to throw out there because it's a totally different style.
Yeah.
Not fantastical at all. And yet, you know, important.
Lady Gaga looks amazing in that
movie.
She
looks so beautiful and stunning. And also the like kind of rugged country look that Bradley Cooper has is very influenced by his alcoholism, which, you know, is a part of the movie. So these days, she serves as a judge on the sci-fi original series Face Off, which is about makeup artists competing for grand prize, whatever. Mm-hmm. So she's one of the main judges on that. In 2017, she accepted the position of director of education at Cinema Makeup School here in LA. Mm. And then in 2021, she started her own school, Legends Makeup Academy.
Wow.
And I don't know. If I was a makeup artist, she's the person I would want to learn from.
Yeah.
Especially as a woman. Mm-hmm. And she's talked a lot in her interviews about being a woman in the industry and all that kind of stuff. And she's definitely an inspiration or a North Star for a lot of people. But, and of course, the other thing I have to mention is that her career is not her alone. So like all of these characters that I've mentioned, she is not the only person behind them. Makeup departments don't work like that.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people who touch a lot of people. But her creative vision is definitely an essential part of many of these characters. And to have been a part of all of these projects and the head of so many is just really cool.
Yeah, very amazing.
So with that, I wanted to just share her credits that she's been nominated for and or won.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, she has won an Academy Award for Beetlejuice, Mrs. Doubtfire, and Ed Wood. She's also been nominated for Edward Scissorhands, Batman Returns, Hoffa, Pirates of the Caribbean, The Curse of the Black Pearl, and Pirates of the Caribbean at World's End.
Mm.
And who knows? She could still do more.
That's true.
And so that's what I have to share today about makeup artist V. Neal.
Very cool. Didn't know much about her, but
I know,
I've seen so much of her work.
Yeah, we all kind of know
her
characters, so may as well.
Well, with that, we come to the end of the show in which we thank the Academy for things relating to the people that we talk about, the films that we discuss. What would you like to thank the Academy for today, Kristen?
First, I would like to thank the Academy for Girls Who Love Monsters.
Yeah.
It's a fun world to live in. And people often, especially earlier on, not so much anymore, but underestimated the ladies when it came to the scary stuff. And V. Neal is one of the people who really pushed back against that.
Nice. I would like to thank the Academy for influential people influencing other influential people.
Ah.
It's one of the like big things of Hollywood history.
Yes.
Is these like family trees of
not
people necessarily real family, but like the people who help other people get their work started.
Yeah.
And then those people help other people and influence them to get their work done.
Yeah.
It's very, very cool.
It is wonderful. Who was it? Robin Williams, who saw Jessica Chastain and, you know, helped her get going. And I mean, over and over.
Yeah. Very cool.
I would like to thank the Academy for Toons.
Toons.
I love Toons.
Yeah.
I love animated storytelling.
So
and it's
fun.
So exciting to be in this era of talking about movies where we're going to get to talk about a lot more and we get to talk about so many different cool things that are happening.
Yeah. Animation and like CGI and all of that is really going to dominate Hollywood through the 90s.
Yeah.
Very interesting. I would like to thank the Academy for iconic transcendent characters. Whose looks and attitudes and everything just like jump off the screen, which is often helped by their makeup.
Yeah, it's
very
so
cool.
True.
It's such something that you don't think about if that is not like your penchant for like art in that way. Like you can watch a movie and just take it all in, which is like what the point of it is. But often you're not sitting there thinking like, of all the time and effort and the thinking and everything, the planning that goes into all of that stuff.
Mm-hmm. The creativity, too, to communicate.
Yeah. But, of course, it creates such iconic and memorable characters. I mean, some of those characters are, like, the most memorable screen characters of the last 40 years.
Absolutely.
Very, very cool. Well, with that, we come to the end of our episode. And we thank you for joining us and listening. And thank you for sharing it with your friends if you like
Please
it.
Do.
Thank you for subscribing
yeah.
and giving us ratings and reviews. All yeah. of that helps get the show out there and put it in front of more ear holes. So thanks. And then join us next week when we discuss the 62nd Academy Awards and the 62nd Best Picture winner, Driving Miss Daisy.
Thank you for tuning in to Thank the Academy. You can follow us on social media at Thank the Academy Podcast on Instagram and Thank Academy Pod on X. If you enjoy listening to the show, make sure to leave a 5-star rating on Apple and Spotify podcasts and subscribe on your favorite streaming platforms. The theme song was created by the one and only Noah Heisinger. Join us next week on Thank the Academy.